session number 25197, Real 7.
Derek Bartlett, Reel 7. Yes, you were telling me now, you're now on your way to America.
Yes, we left Christchurch in New Zealand, across the Pacific, to the Panama Canal.
Right. But you were saying this was, again, a very crowded ship, is that right?
It was not uncomfortably crowded in the sense that everybody had somewhere to sleep. Cabin, etc. But it was very full, yes.
And were you all in one cabin again?
No, we had two cabins that time.
And what about the journey? Was there any threat, submarine or otherwise?
I think, as far as I remember, that there were Japanese submarines operating in the South Pacific, yeah. But we didn't have any problem with that. We had a very bad storm on the way across. I can't remember whether my mother said that it was the result of a hurricane that was crossing the Pacific at that time. But it was certainly very, very bad indeed. Fortunately, it was a much bigger ship than the Nanking, so we didn't suffer quite so much. But one thing I do recall is that the captain... There were. I was nine and a quarter then, I suppose, and I was in the company of about eight lads who were all in that sort of range, 9, 10, and 11, all English, and there wasn't a lot to do on the ship for young boys like that. So of course we had a natural tendency to get in a certain amount of mischief. But on that particular occasion, when that storm, we hit that storm, the skipper asked us to go up to the wheelhouse one day. Now, it was a big ship, so from the wheelhouse, one could see the whole of the fore part of the ship, really, the bows, quite a long distance. And he said that the waves were about 60 feet. And I could believe it, because as the ship, we were bows on to the direction of the waves, of course. And as the ship approached one of these waves, it would rise, but it would not rise right to the top, so that the bows of the ship would disappear into this mountain of green water, and. It would then virtually flood the whole fore part of the ship, and then very slowly it would come up again, you know. But one could, I remember standing there thinking, well, this time it's not going to come up, you know, we're just going to go down. But we always did come up. I gave my mother cause for some concern across the Pacific, because as I said before, we were always getting into some kind of mischief. And one day, not during that storm, I hasten to say, the sea was much calmer. Pacific, I've never understood why it's called the Pacific, because it very rarely is. And there was quite a swell, significant swell. And we were standing again on the sports deck. Near the bows of the ship, and I suppose there was a run of rail, ships, the teak rail that they normally have, would have been about 35 to 40 feet, a clear run of this to the bows, you know. And one of the older lads said to us, we were all there, and he said, "Bet you can't jump up on the rail and walk along to the other end." So we did. And of course, the ship was rising and falling in its forward direction, as it were. But because ships do, it was pitching from one side to the other. As it rose up, it pitched to one side, and then it rose up and pitched the other way. And there we were, with our arms outstretched like this, pigeon stepping along this row, which is only about, 16 inches wide at the very most. And I was talking to my mother many years later, and I said to her, she said, "Oh yes, I saw you doing that." Well, of course I knew she had. And I said, "Well, how did you feel about it?" So she said, "Well, I hadn't seen you for 2 or 3 hours at least. I knew that you usually meant you were up to something." So I went up to the sports deck, which was the natural place to start looking. And she said, "I came up the steps to the deck itself, looked up the deck, and there were these 8 boys walking along the rail as the ship rose and fell, you know." And she said, "I just simply couldn't believe it. My heart almost stopped, you know." And she said, "My first reaction was to rush forward and grab you." And she said, "I thought, well, I'll almost certainly send at least 2 others into the sea." And of course, they would not have stopped had that happened. So she stood and prayed.
What was it like going through the Panama Canal?
It was a very interesting thing for all of us, I think. I'd certainly never seen anything quite like it. The ship was just about... I don't think the canal would have taken anything much bigger. It was just about the biggest problem. Because in places, the canal itself is actually quite narrow. And then there are the Gatun Lakes in the middle. So you come to these, what is almost like a swamp, really. And I don't know how long it took to get through. Quite a long time, actually. In fact, it was very, very slow. They have motorized, what are they really? Almost like engines. They're electric, I think, or diesel. Like steam engines. And they have a cable to each one of these from the bow and the stern. So there are 4 of them. And that keeps the ship in the center. So you're not grinding along the side of the canal, you see. So it's concrete, of course. And as I say, it's a 2-part journey because the lakes are in the centre. And I can't remember whether it's Cristobal, which is on the Pacific side, and Panama is on the other side. I'm not quite sure which way around it is. But anyway, we arrived at the other end and made our way through the Gulf of Mexico, past the Caribbean islands, which we saw in the distance, to up the Mississippi to New Orleans. And that was quite an experience because Mississippi, I don't know exactly how far it is up the estuary, but it's a long way, many, many miles. And it's very flat, of course, in that whole area. So really one is aware of this vast river, and the width is enormous. It's almost like being at sea, you know, when one is first going up the river. And then gradually we came to the docks of the city beyond. But one thing we were aware of a long time before we actually arrived at the docks was that the fields on either side were filled with aircraft and vehicles of all kinds, which were being manufactured there and shipped over to Britain.
That must have been quite a sight.
Yes, that's right. And huge, I mean, enormous area, covered with these bombing and fighter planes, ready to be shipped across to Europe, to Britain, of course. And to the Far East, I suppose. Yes, it was really quite something. And we were also very aware of the alligators on the mud banks in those days. I don't know whether they're still there now. But I do remember seeing them.
So what with sharks and alligators, yes. You were getting quite a lot.
I was indeed, yes.
Were you going to be refitted at this stage?
Yes, the ship was in its normal peacetime colours then. and it had a couple of very tall masts, as usual, and two funnels, I think. And we went into dry dock first. We were taken off and put into the Monteleone Hotel in uptown New Orleans. And the ship went into dry dock. And they shortened the mast by about 50%, and they painted it in the standard camouflage, grey and black. It was very, I think it was mandatory for ships in those days. And they mounted anti-aircraft guns, Bofors guns. They mounted a 3-inch gun on the stern. And the thing was bristling with guns at the end of it, at the end of that exercise. Shortened the funnels. Really changed its appearance quite fundamentally. Yeah.
And this was for the Atlantic crossing, I suppose.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Yes. So how were you treated? This is now America, the land of milk and honey.
Well, first of all, I would say that one was barely, apart from what we saw that I was just describing, and the fact that there were quite a lot of people in uniform, of course. But if one left that aside, one would never have known that there was a war going on at all. There was petrol rationing, I believe, but apart from that, there was anything. I mean, I can remember going to milk bars with my mother and my sisters, and the first time we did this, we ordered a sandwich each, you see. And the bartender said, you mean a sandwich? And my mother said, yes, a sandwich, four sandwiches. And this thing came, each one was about 9 inches high. He was amazed that we wanted four sandwiches. One sandwich would have been done very nicely. But she didn't understand. That was again, you see, another cultural difference. And there were posters around the city with slogans like, buy war bonds and help Uncle Sam to defeat the Japs and all that sort of thing. But apart from that, I don't think one could have lived there almost without knowing that the Second World War was going on. No food rationing, any kind, of course. So it was really a different... Well, in fact, it was more like the world we had known in Singapore in some respects, you see. And then we hadn't been there more than 2-3 days, and the phone call came through to the hotel from... Mrs. Dunlap, who was the chairwoman of the Women's Volunteer Service in New Orleans. And they'd been advised that we were there. And, of course, there were many other refugees from the ship as well. We weren't the only people she contacted. But they were very kind to us indeed, you know. They took us about in their cars and showed us the city. Nothing was too much. And we went regularly to dinner with her and her husband, who was a professor of English at Louisiana University. And he was very taken with our accents and wanted to take me to meet his students. And my mother wouldn't let me go. She said she thought it would be too bad for my ego.
This was no longer Australian, I imagine.
No. They were fascinated. American people, I've come across this in recent years, seem to be fascinated by English accents. I'm not quite sure why. We have some friends in Texas who we like very much. They used to love sitting just listening to us talking. I'm not quite sure why that is, but it's a phenomenon that's well known.
So how long were you in America?
We were in New Orleans. It took about 3 weeks for the ship to be modified. And during that time, we were in the hotel. And we saw one particularly sad thing. Mrs. Dunlap took us to a United States Air Force base just outside New Orleans. And my mother and I, she wouldn't take the other two children. We went to a hospital that was there. And we were introduced to a young man who had been an American fighter pilot in the Pacific only a few months before, and he'd been shot down by the Japanese, landed in very shallow water. Now, I don't know quite where this would have been, but in one of the theatres of war in the Pacific. And the unfortunately, the plane caught fire, and he virtually lost his face. But he could still see, and they had taken off the dressings, and his face had virtually gone. But he could still speak. He'd got his... He had his lips and his eyes, nose had gone. And they took us, my mother and I went to see him he was in a private room. And he was a truly horrific sight. But he was so full of hope.
That was quite a lot for a young boy of 10, wasn't it? To take in.
Yeah. I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like that. I had seen Chinese people in Singapore who had lost their noses as a result of syphilis. So I did know that it was possible, but I didn't know anything about syphilis. My mother would never, of course, tell me. She used to say, oh, they caught some unfortunate disease, you know, and had to have their noses cut off, you see. That's all she would ever say to me. So when I saw him, it was not the first time I'd seen somebody without a nose, but I hadn't seen anybody without his features virtually. It was really quite traumatic, yeah.
Had you heard from your father at this time? Bearing in mind you've left him in a very dangerous situation.
My father was not permitted to go, of course. The men had to stay behind. But he was in a rather different situation from the ordinary service people, in the sense that although he was commission officer in the RAF at that point, he was not there for the purpose progressing the war. He was effectively a civilian, really. And I believe that, from what he told me, that the authorities there decided that since he was effectively a non-combatant, it would be better to permit people in that category to go if they wanted to. Now, he wasn't attached to any particular unit. So he received a phone call to the effect that if he wished to go, he could. And this was literally about 24 hours before the place capitulated.
So he could revert to his civilian status?
Yes. So he went down to the docks in the car at night. That night, that was immediately before the capitulation. And he walked along the quayside. It was pure speculation. He didn't know there was going to be a ship or not. And he came across a small ship, still anchored by the, still tied up to the wharf. And he stood at the bottom of the gangway, and somebody said, "Are you RAF?" And he said, "Yes." And the man said, "Hop aboard, we're just leaving." And he did, and they left. And as they left Keppel Harbour, they passed Japanese invasion craft entering the harbour from the opposite direction. And he got down to Batavia in Indonesia. And from there, after a very long period of time, not knowing what was happening, he wasn't able to get a passage. Nobody took responsibility for him. They were put there and just left, you know. He managed finally to, and of course the Japanese were already planning to attack Java, as we know. He found a ship going to Colombo, and he managed to get onto that, and eventually from Colombo, he went to Bombay, Cape Town, and then Liverpool.
So but it would have been some time before you knew where he was.
Yes, to answer your question, he tried to keep up with our progress through the authorities, but they kept informing him. For example, they told him we were in Perth, and he knew that that's where we'd been heading. But we'd left by the time the cable reached Perth. So he cabled Adelaide, and we'd left by the time the cable reached Adelaide. Every time he cabled, we'd just departed, you see. So my mother never really knew where he was until we got back to the United Kingdom.
So, you know, what were the events after New Orleans? Did you go straight off from there?
What happened then was that when the ship came out of dry dock, we went into different parts of the docks. And one particularly striking thing I witnessed was the two holds, because there were two very, very big holds, one fore and aft. And they put the tanks and heavy armoured equipment and heavy vehicles at the bottom of the hold. And then we went to a completely different part of the docks where they had these so-called grain silos. And then they poured the grain into the holds over the vehicles that were already there. Now, I didn't realise this at the time, but I was told later, the purpose of that was to stabilise the heavy equipment at the bottom. The grain acted like almost like a liquid, so it completely stabilised it. It was a very clever idea. And we also took on a vast quantity of war material in the form of aircraft, small armoured vehicles, so-called soft-skinned vehicles like jeeps, thousands of boxes of ammunition of every kind. It was all strapped down to the decks at every level. There wasn't a square foot that wasn't occupied by something. There must have been millions of dollars worth of war material on that one ship. And thus, loaded to the gunwales, together with a number of American Air Force personnel, we left New Orleans and went round Florida and up past the correction. Round up to the eastern seaboard. And we didn't call in at New York. We stopped. I'll say we stopped in the harbour, but we never had any opportunity to disembark at all. And I don't know why they went in there, but did. And it was only for a very short time. And then we left again and went up to Halifax, Nova Scotia in Canada. So at that point, we had Royal Australian Air Force personnel, Royal New Zealand Air Force, and American Air Force personnel, and some British. And when we got to Halifax, some of them who were going to be trained in Canada disembarked at that point, and the others came across the Atlantic with us. And there we were there several days, while in fact quite a while, until the next big convoy could be put together. And we joined that, and we crossed the Atlantic to Glasgow, but we left the convoy when we reached this side of the Atlantic. We went up to Reykjavik in Iceland, and I have no idea why we went there, but we went there. But we went there as an individual ship, and the rest of the convoy went on, I can only assume to Glasgow. But we went individually. We left the convoy, and I don't know why we did. There was never any explanation for that.
There was no unloading when you got there?
No, none at all, no. Don't know why we did it at all. And it was very cold. But the worst part of the journey was undoubtedly the Atlantic crossing. No doubt at all about that.
What was so awful about that?
U-boat attacks. The Atlantic was divided into three sections in those days. There was it was approximately 3,000 miles. The 1,000 miles from the American coast was covered by American and Canadian escorts. And the 1,000 miles from the United Kingdom out towards the west was also covered by our escorts. But there was 1,000 miles in the middle that wasn't covered by any escorts, and that's where the U-boats used to really hit. And we crossed the Atlantic. It would have been then, I would say, getting on for the end of August, perhaps early, very early September. And the U-boat war hadn't actually reached its climax at that point, but it was certainly moving towards that.
Because this is 1942, we're talking about, isn't it?
Now, a convoy goes at the pace of the slowest ship. The ship we were in was capable of doing probably 18 knots, maybe more than that, probably quite a lot more, bearing in mind that a sea knot is faster, you know, it's faster than the land one. But we had to plod along at about, probably at about 8 knots, you know. Some of the smaller cargo ships couldn't do much more than about 10 knots. But the net result was, of course, that everybody was moving very slowly. You know. And I mean, just to recount some of the things I remember seeing. I remember seeing American and Canadian destroyers dropping depth charges during a U-boat attack. Remember seeing a tanker. I got, like all children, who get up very early. And I got up one morning, I suppose it would have been not long after dawn. And they used to like attacking at dawn and dusk because the ships were silhouetted against the sky. And a tanker, which was in the next row to ours in the convoy, was hit by a torpedo and it went up like an atomic bomb. And I remember seeing some of the crew who, by some miracle, had been thrown into the water or dived into the water, had actually survived up to that point, but drowned in the oil, which was burning. And there was an attempt to pick some of them up with a launch, with a small motor launch, but they couldn't get near it because of the heat. So that was something I remember witnessing quite clearly. We hit a very strange thing happened. I was talking to my mother about this journey, and I must have been 40 at the time, and I said to my mother, I wasn't entirely sure about this because my memory had become a bit hazy. I said to my mother, I seem to remember that we struck a U-boat. We rammed a U-boat. And she said, oh dear, I had hoped she'd forgotten about that. And she told me that what happened was the U-boat, for some reason or other, it was never established why, had actually come up to the surface. And he'd made the fatal error of coming up almost immediately, bows on to the buzzer vane, and we rammed him right in the amidships. And some of the U-boat crew, and again, these things happen, one doesn't know how they could possibly have survived, but they actually were bobbing about in the water and they were alive. And they were picked up, but not by us.
That must have been a very frightening experience, wasn't it, for a young boy?
It was a very anxious time, simply because when one is in a ship and that ship is being subjected to submarine attack, there's this constant nagging thought in the back of the mind that never goes away, that is there when you go to sleep and it's there the moment you wake up. That the next few minutes could be the next few minutes where you hear that bang and you know it's been hit. And that lasted all the way across the Atlantic. And I know everybody else, my mother said she felt it as well. But the problem with it was that because it was all so uncertain, we were having U-boat alarms going off at all times of the day and night. And when we were in the middle section, the central 1,000 miles, the captain insisted on all the passengers sleeping on the sports deck at night. Yes. And we had to take our mattresses and our blankets and our pillows up on the sports deck at dusk and sleep on the sports deck. Because obviously he must have felt that the danger was so great. We used to wake up feeling rats running over us. And my mother insisted on having